The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber. It's coming up to 3 years since Uber and the GMB union signed a landmark recognition agreement, the first of its kind in the gig economy.
Having that recognition with GMB union shows that Uber's serious about drivers' protection.
Ali Haydor drives with Uber and he works as a representative for the GMB union.
The workers contract what the drivers have got is thanks to GMB. They're getting sick pay, national living wage, holiday pension. They're also able to choose the hours they want to work and the days they want to work. Also, they get to choose the jobs they want to do. Now, that is a proper work-life balance. It's full flexibility at the same time as good standard of wage there.
A wide range of issues come from all over the country from our members, and we'll take these issues to the company, discuss with the management, and the team will actually accommodate that. Now, you couldn't get that kind of access on a collective voice if you didn't have the recognition agreement.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast, now restored to
the all-stars, yeah. As I like to think about
it. Yeah, it's full roster.
How did you keep it warm for me while I was away?
Yeah, people liked it. Some listeners didn't want you to come back.
Wow. Well, screw them, because I'm here and I've got a lot of thoughts about Labour. We've got loads to get through. Shall we start with boundary changes, because that is the kind of wonkery for which I think there is an appetite. So the Boundary Commission has come back with its review to reduce the number of seats from 650 to 600. There's inevitably been a row about the ones that have been redrawn. So George Osborne's seat is gone.
Yeah, George Osborne's seat of Tatton.
Jez We Can is now Jez We Are Homeless.
Yeah, so, I mean, we always sort of thought that might happen to Islington North. It was the geographically smallest.
It's teeny, isn't it?
Yeah, it's teeny tiny. It has the
If it was an island, it'd be all right.
Yeah, it has the highest density of social housing, which also means it has a large amount of turnover and people moving around. So it was vulnerable for all sorts of reasons, because there are basically two elements of the boundary changes. One, which is impeccably fair, and weirdly a lot of MPs have decided to criticise that one, and then one which is really dodgy, right?
So, well, it's the kind of classic algorithm thing, isn't it? Is that algorithms are themselves neutral, but they are programmed by people with bias, and that's exactly what's happened here, is that the process itself has been scrupulously fair, but the terms and conditions it operated under were only ever going to produce a result that was helpful to the Conservatives.
Yeah. So there's equalising the sizes of constituencies unless you're an island, which, to be honest, is fair enough. If you were a voter on the Wirral, your vote counted for literally double that of the vote of someone in, I'm trying to think, one of the largest constituencies, the Isle of Wight, which is a bad example because obviously they will still be unrepresented because they're still an island.
What I'm saying is they should dig a moat round Islington North and then it would have survived
and
unchanged.
I'm obviously aggrieved by this because in practice, of course, Jeremy will get another seat. It feels likely then what will happen is that he will get Finsbury Park and Stoke Newington.
So the Socialist Republic of Stoke Newington will now move from under the glorious stewardship of Diane Abbott, who's your current MP.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to upset our Corbynite listeners, but I like Diane Abbott. I like voting for her. I don't want to vote for Jeremy. I liked voting for Diane. I'm really unhappy about this development. I'm also more annoyed because they've then continued eastward, drawing increasingly ridiculous boundaries. So, like, Finsbury Park and Stoke Newington, fair enough, that's a place, it's quite a nice name. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably bad news for renters, because my instinct is that is a name which is going to increase property prices right there. Finsbury Park and Stoke Newington.
Sounds a lot nicer.
Sounds very leafy. Yeah. Hackney North, you know, people are still scared of Hackney. The other day I had to bite my tongue not to turn and... So there was this couple clearly going on the world's worst date. And the bearded man said very confidently, Clapton is still pretty shady. I mean, Clapton is not only not shady now, but even when I was a child, I used to go to violin lessons in Clapton. So the idea that Clapton has ever been, you
much
know...
Much as Snoop Dogg used to in Compton into his violin lessons.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously ridiculous. Hackney Central, fair enough. You know, you can't... Hackney West and Bethnal Green, that's not a place. That goes over a local authority. People, like, it's like, if you're going to do that, call it Shoreditch and Bethnal Green. And that is just...
That sounds shishy. Yeah,
there are lots of big losers. From
Caroline Lucas is another really interesting one, right?
So Caroline Lucas is an odd one. So she's basically, again, we, Brighton Pavilion, small, lot of students. So we kind of suspected that would happen. Now, the odd thing is, Caroline Lucas has talked a lot about an electoral pact. I would back Caroline Lucas to win the new seat, provided there is not an electoral pact with Labour.
So let me get this right. So she has suggested that Labour and the Greens don't run against each other.
Yeah.
But she needs Labour peeling off some of the Tory vote in order that she can come down the middle in the new seat.
Yeah, so in 2010, what the Greens did, and they ran a brilliant campaign, and one of my great regrets is if I had, you know, not been, you know, a mere fetus, as it were, then, I would have loved to cover that campaign because it was a brilliant, very clever bit where they worked out exactly what they needed to do to win. She got something like 29% of the vote and she came through the middle. And I would back her to do that again in the new constituency in terms of the notional results. You can kind of see how she'd eat enough of the Labour vote. However, and this is part of the broader problem with electoral pacts, voters don't behave in a wholly rational way. We saw this with Lib Dems, right? So if you are politically informed and you voted Lib Dem, in the 2015 election, you mostly voted Labour, right? If you weren't, you were voted Tory. And that was one of the things the polls were picking up too much of. They had too many hyper-informed Lib Dems and not enough less-informed Lib Dems who did not vote in a way which perhaps seems rational. And it's kind of the same with Labour voters and electoral pacts with the Greens. There are lots of Labour voters, including in Brighton, whose second choice, if there's not a Labour candidate, is not going to be the Green Party. In some cases it'll be UKIP, in some cases it'll be the Tories.
I think that's one of the great curiosities of the last election, and it's a really good lesson for the Lib Dems, or something they certainly need to grapple with, is that you get punished for being in coalition with a party that lots of people dislike by people voting for the party that they apparently dislike over you, right?
Yeah.
Which makes no logical sense on that. You'd be like, I think it's wrong that the Lib Dems went into coalition with the Tories. I'm going to vote Tory.
Well, I think their problem is I think the people who voted Tory over the Lib Dems didn't feel that way. The mistake they made, but I don't see how they would have survived doing what they needed, because what they needed to do is basically go, you love the coalition, so do we, coalition's great, vote Lib Dem. However, doing that would have signed the death warrants of every Lib Dem MP fighting Labour, every Lib Dem MP in a city. I mean, of course, as it turned out, that happened anyway.
Yeah.
But you can see, you know, if they'd done that, imagine what Vince Cable would have done the day after. Their problem was, is that they were like, you know, it was like the dog with two bones.
I don't know the story. Go
on. So there's a dog, it's got a bone, it comes to a pond.
Right.
And it sees another dog in the pond with a bone.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, it kind of gives the dog a hard stare, and you can give me my bone. And the other dog gives it a hard stare back and gives it another head. So he growls and the other dog growls. And eventually it's like, right, I'm going to show you my bark. It opens its mouth to bark and the bone drops from its mouth into the pond and it can't retrieve it because it's...
And how does that got to do with the Lib Dems?
And so the Lib Dem, right, so the bone in this case, actually I don't think this works, but the bone was the, on the one hand you've got Lib Dems who are facing the Tories, right? And what they needed to do, they were actually the bone in the dog's mouth, right?
Yeah.
What they needed to do is go, look, I've got this bone.
Yeah.
The people who are facing the Labour Party, they're underwater. They might not think it, they might get smiled at when they go and open a tombola. But, you know, Lynn Featherstone, she's gone.
Yeah.
Simon Hughes, gone. What they needed to do is go, right, I'm going to leave that bone in the water. It's not actually a real bone. But instead they went, we'll just bark for a bit.
Yeah.
And then the bone they actually had fell into the water and was lost.
I think you pulled that back.
I pulled that one back, yeah.
Let's dwell on the Lib Dems a little bit more, because I think actually that there is an opportunity for the Lib Dems now, right? I think there is a hard ceiling on the potential vote that they get, but... all this stuff, I think the polling puts kind of what they call metropolitan elite voters at 8%, right? And not all of those people will go to Corbyn's Labour. Some of them will, I think, definitely. But there are others who are more centrist, but still are really motivated by things like Europe. I think there are more votes to be kind of scrambled up by the Lib Dems, particularly if you think that the May government is, let's face it, probably going to be quite authoritarian, quite illiberal, right? It must have been hard for them to fight against Cameroonian conservatism because, you know, he's the PM who dropped ID cards. Actually, things like the Snoopers Charter never... I mean, he wouldn't... If it had been up to Cameron, right, the Snoopers Charter would never have...
Yeah, and I mean, in many ways, I would say the great tragedy, and then I remember that we've left the EU. One of the great tragedies of Cameron's premiership was that he did not give voice to his natural instincts on, for example, drug reform, which, you know, actually, even if it what happened with the EU, that would cast his legacy in a very different light.
Yeah. Or if they started doing prison reform, like, more than 10 minutes before.
Yeah, and prison reform, that is gone. That is hole below the waterline.
Which I think is really sad, right? I mean, I'm in the middle of writing up a piece about prisons, having been to some earlier in the summer, but there was a sort of sense of, I wouldn't say excitement, because I think people have seen promises and made and then junked in the kind of cold glare of tabloid headlines before about prison reform. But I actually think it was not a replica of the resistance of the schools and teachers and the education establishment to Michael Gove's school reforms, right? I think actually there was a sense in the prison sector that more autonomy for governors particularly was exactly what they needed. And actually that would have, for example, allowed them a lot more control over things like outsourcing contracts, which have been kind of pretty much imposed on them. And actually for a really long time with very hard penalties for break clauses that mean you end up just paying huge amounts of money to people who aren't delivering a great service with no way to hold them to account. So I'm sad about prison reform.
Yeah, and I think that's part of Theresa May kind of viewing the Ministry of Justice effectively as a... Yeah, you know, one minister has said to me she views it as a rogue outpost of the Home Office, and she always has done.
Well, you know, that's it's spun off. I mean, ironically, though, when you and I have had this conversation before, does her survival as Home Secretary, is that down to the fact that she wasn't responsible for all the things that Department of Justice were responsible for, which traditionally may have sunk previous Home Secretaries?
Well, one very interesting you ask us, which I think is so interesting that we should actually do it as a written blog, is Theresa May good or lucky?
That's a really interesting question.
Because it is, and that is one of the many questions, but just that, the having trouble is a bet on, as her shadow, you know.
The trouble is, on terror stuff, it's almost impossible to say, because you hear about the thwarted plans 2 years later when they finally get to a terror trial at the Old Bailey, right? Yeah. There's no real-time way of assessing, actually, how the Home Secretary made those calls when they were actually happening.
Yeah.
Let's quickly talk about grammar schools, which also kind of plays into the fact that it just feels to me like Theresa May has decided to laser target a particular group of voters. And I would think of them mostly as sort of soft UKIP voters in the home counties. I mean, she's come up with... I find it strange that grammar schools was the first thing that she decided to do. I mean, you know, it's sort of a weird... Not only is it a big sort of screw you to Cameron, it's kind of slightly screw you to Thatcher.
Yeah.
And it's certainly a big screw you to the 80% of teachers, I think, who are against them. And actually, not just... I know there's a perception that all teachers are sort of raving NUT lefties, but actually there's... You know, it's opposed to Michael Gove's...
Well, a plurality of teachers did still vote for the Conservatives in the 2015 election. Yeah, it is, as they say in business, it's a bold move.
Courageous.
Because, I mean, the slight difficulty is... You know, you sometimes have to use the word educational establishment because there's no other shorthand, but there isn't really one apart from on issues like grammar schools, which actually do unite everyone who's into education policy from kind of the NUT all the way through to
the Avengers
heads of
Assembly.
Most major academies.
Avengers Assembly, that's the school version of Avengers Assemble.
I think one of the things I find intriguing about it is, so obviously they're briefing very hard there won't be an election. But you think, how are you going to get that through the Lords? You think you're going to have opposition from the founders of academy chains, many of whom now have peerages. It just feels like it only makes sense as an election issue because...
But also I can see the roots of... I mean, one of the reasons you might say that David Cameron stepped down as an MP was so that he would never have to vote on that. Like, how do you vote on someone who's obviously dismantling a legacy? How does George Osborne vote on that? Michael Gove, surprisingly, has said that he will vote for grammar schools, which is a kind of... Who knows? Who knows what crazy guy's up to? Nicky Morgan said she's against it. There was another Tory MP who stood up in the chamber.
Alex Shelbrooks was against it.
Your 12 majority begins to look quite... I mean,
at that point, because my assumption is... And I actually should ask him, but my assumption is Graham Stewart will be against it, because he is always... You know, had religion on this idea of no, you know, there's... Because the really... I mean, there are One, the statistics are against grammar schools, and I say that as someone who, you know, went to a comprehensive before.
Well, you're the only
stopped.
Person. Hang on a minute, but how good was your comprehensive? Because if your comprehensive was too good, I now learn that you're not allowed to have an opinion.
You're not
on
allowed
this.
To. I mean, it was in London, so obviously, you know, that discredits me because it's, you know, that London.
Yeah.
And you know, it was rated good by Ofsted when I was there. It's now
Sorry.
Outstanding, so I guess that. But you know,
that proves that comprehensives don't work.
It did, but I mean, like the whole point of the agenda in education reform, and obviously there was some sharp changes when the Conservatives came in, but from Blunkett to Nicky Morgan, the whole point was you didn't accept, quite rightly, this idea that there was a large number of pupils where it was acceptable to throw your hands in the air and go, oh, what can we do? They're poor. And that is effectively the argument about grammar schools. It's like, what can we do? Some people are just thick. And, you know, ultimately, you know, without wishing to alienate like hundreds of my sources, like every law firm, civil service department and bank is full of upper middle class people who, to be frank, are, you know, they're perfectly nice people, but they're not the sharpest people in the world. They've just had social advantages, and there is absolutely no excuse for an education system which can't turn even the most unremarkable child into a middle manager in a bank or a mid-ranking departmental official in the Treasury or whatever. If you're someone who's given me a story who's a mid-ranking official, I am not talking about you. You are very clever.
I think they're more pernicious generally than private schools, which lots of people on the left are, because private schools say, you know, other people have more money than you. But grammar schools say at 11... other people are more intelligent than you, and you're the detritus.
And also, they don't take resource out of the system. You know, people. So you know, people still pay their taxes. State schools can and do drive them out of business. I mean, like, to be honest, in London, mostly now, if you're sending your kids to private school, I mean, you might as well have burned that money. The output is just not, you know, kind of, it's one of those things where...
Well, you just don't want them ever to have to talk to a poor person. I think
yeah.
that's basically...
I mean, that thing is, like, so they have become more sinister in a way, particularly in London, where it's like, well, what are you really paying for here?
Facilities, though, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I knew somebody who went to a private school that had a shooting range. I mean, you don't get... I mean, maybe in the hood.
Well, in bits
the,
of Hackney, yeah,
in the hood
still
of Hackney, you do have that. But yeah, I mean, that, I think that's something that... Anyway, I went to private school, so I'm definitely not. Which is a choice that I made at the age of 3. Actually, I was very precocious. That's probably why I've done so well in life. that's probably enough of that. What do you think of the photo of the new cabinet? Just to finish.
I mean, I hadn't realised just how many white bald men there were in that. Like,
just... the Russian doll set that starts with Chris Grayling and then like works his way down to kind of, yeah, I know. I did. The whiteness was the first thing that kind of came to me. And the fact that men in politics need to just break the hegemony of the navy suit. You know, live a little, guys. Maybe a discreet check. You know, just get there. In the
well, think, yeah, even if someone was wearing steel grey in that, you'd be like, who's that dynamic go-getter?
It's an interesting. I mean, obviously, it's much more diverse in educational terms. I think what is it, 70% state educated.
Yeah.
So it's, but it, I mean, yeah, a kind of cruel reminder that there are many way different ways to slice diversity.
But I think one of the interesting things for a final thought about the new cabinet, and indeed about the new government, is it is basically the Conservative Party under May is a coalition of lower middle class people who've done well for themselves, whose political mission is to make lower middle class people do well for themselves and to protect people who have done well for themselves. They are not concerned about the power of an overmighty rich to rig the system all that much, and they are not particularly concerned about the condition of the poor, which is fairly depressing for policy terms. But the scary thing is, electorally, the coalition of people who either want to be or are lower middle class, or want to have done well from themselves from being lower middle class, that is very potent. And so it's, you know, it is fairly scary.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And together we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can get this episode and everything else we've done on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time to go down the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So yesterday at Prime Minister's Questions, Jeremy Corbyn had the rare experience of being almost universally declared the winner by the Westminster Press and probably in the view of most MPs. A week later than most Labour MPs thought he should have done, he went on grammar schools, and Theresa May struggled. She struggled to explain why the new schools were needed. She played the personal card saying, you went to a grammar school, I went to a grammar school, they're why we're here today. But Corbyn wasn't thrown, of course. He said he clearly knows his views on this issue. The selection at 11 is fundamentally wrong, and it's not. We don't just need a ladder for some children, we need a ladder for all. And the Labour benches visibly united around him. There were even cheers heard. And it showed how Theresa May's decision to open this classic left-right dividing line has reminded some of Corbyn's friends and foes why they're in the same party.
Yeah, so that was obviously a big win, which, you know, we all expect. I feel now even Owen Smith's supporters are no longer actively trying to convince one that he is going to win.
Absolutely. Everyone's mind has turned to what happens when Corbyn wins, not if he'll win. And as you say, although there are some who are holding out, who say we are not going to serve under him in any circumstances, we'd look absurd if we did, having voted no confidence in him. We don't just think he's unelectable, we also think he's a bad man. There are others who take the view, as some did originally, we have to try and make this work. We have to look like a reasonably competent opposition. And actually, on economic and social issues, grammar schools among them, further spending cuts, rail, housing, there's actually quite a lot that the Corbynites and their opponents have in common.
Yeah. Then, of course, in the evening, something happened which reminded people of the things that divide them. There was this list published, this enemies list, effectively.
That's right. So there was a list of 13 Labour MPs, including Tom Watson, Jess Phillips, Tristram Hunt, issued by Corbyn's campaign team. And they were attacked for their abuse of Corbyn and his supporters. So they cited Jess Phillips telling Diane Abbott to F off, Tom Watson calling Momentum a rabble. And it was accompanied by a quote from a spokesman saying Owen Smith must disown these MPs and condemn them. Then I spoke to a senior Corbyn ally who told me this has caused anger and dismay among Jeremy's supporters at Westminster. He said it was the work of a pound shop, Malcolm Tucker, and he said this is the height of incompetence from the leadership campaign team. I then subsequently spoke to a figure from the campaign team who blamed it on a junior staffer and said it wasn't intended for official use. And of course, this excuse was roundly mocked by the MPs, and the fallout continues. One of those named on the list, Ben Bradshaw, has written a letter of complaint to Jeremy Corbyn and a formal letter of complaint to Labour's chief whip, to the Parliamentary Labour Party chair and to the General Secretary. But as you say, the bigger point here is how Jeremy Corbyn often seems torn between the path of cooperating with MPs and the path of confrontation, as it should be said, his opponents often are. And it was slightly awkward last night when, after Jeremy Corbyn's campaign had distanced themselves from the list and said it's just the work of a junior staffer, Corbyn then defended the list in his debate with Owen Smith and said, look, all of these comments are on the record already, and pretty much I don't see what the fuss is about.
I think the odd thing is it makes sense, I think, in terms of getting the show on the road, to effectively draw a line and go, right, we'll be conciliatory, but beyond this line, no, no, no. The problem is for that to work, the people on the other side of the line have to be punished in some way. Ben Bradshaw is very popular both in Exeter and in his local party, so they're not going to be able to deselect him. Ditto Jess Phillips. Whereas Tristram Hunt, Jamie Reid, who has a tricky selection battle for the new seat of Workington and Whitehaven, John Woodcock, they are, Tom Blenkinsop, they are more intelligent targets, I think.
Yes.
And I think having that list is probably, it feels like the last leak list, where it's just like the ineptitude as much as the sectarianism is the problem.
Yes, I think that's right. And the frustration for Jeremy Corbyn's supporters at Westminster was that they felt this immediately distracted from the win he'd had at PMQs. And it allows the Tories to say, Just look at how disunited the Labour Party is. You know, you may have noticed our divisions on grammar schools, but they're nothing compared to a party at war with itself. And the internal politics of this are quite interesting, because there's been strong speculation that members of the campaign team will make the transition to the leader's office after Corbyn's likely re-election. And this here is Team Corbyn at Westminster saying, look, if they're going to display incompetence of this kind, then we really don't need them here. To which I'm sure some of them would reply, but the first year didn't exactly go swimmingly at all times. But the bigger point here is, of course, that none of this will make a difference at all to the outcome of the leadership election. And that was a card that Owen Smith intended to use and has used throughout the campaign, that I am more competent, only I can unite the party. And he did pointed to the list last night and said, look, this is effectively a deselection list. You're giving momentum and others a hit list of MPs you want to get rid of. And it's fair to say Corbyn survived that blow.
Right. And we, like Corbyn, will be back next week.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hi, I'm Stephanie.
And I'm John. And we host Skylines, the City Metric podcast, where every 2 weeks we talk about cities, maps and the human world.
Whether the Olympics are good for cities, what it's like to be a woman in a city. And we've had guests like Lauren Elkin, Caroline Criado-Perez.
And Neil Codlin, key role player from Suede, because I'm nearly cool now.
Tune in on iTunes or on Acast.
Check it out.
And now we're joined by Kirsty Stiles, who is the head of NS Tech, to talk about Snowden, whistleblowing, leaks, hacks, and, well, yeah, pretty much everything. There's a film coming out. It's Oliver Stone, isn't it? The director of the Snowden film. And it's got the guy from Third Rock from the Sun, as I will always think of him, as Edward Snowden. Can we just talk a bit, because you interviewed Sarah Harrison, who's been involved with efforts to kind of, well, she was with him in Hong Kong, wasn't she, for like 6 weeks, and then she helped him get to Russia. How tense was that period for him?
How tense was it for him? I didn't get to speak to him myself, but obviously speaking to Sarah, she was there in the hotel room. She was there with him in the airport when they finally made it to Moscow. And she'd actually only become involved at a very, very late stage. He was already in Hong Kong. He'd already gone to Glenn Greenwald and other journalists. And he kind of resigned himself to the fact that he was either going to get killed or he was going to go to prison. He actually didn't have a plan B. And while they were there, maybe it was the journalists that had kind of said it to him, but they were like, maybe you should think about your exit strategy. You know, let's try and see if we can find another way of you, not dying. And so Sarah was over in Australia and she'd actually gone there via Hong Kong. And so coincidentally, she was actually able to get to Hong Kong really quickly without being in plain sight and start working with him using the WikiLeaks team where she still works to find out exactly how they might get out of there and who they might get help from.
Yeah, I think whatever you think about the newsworthiness of the leak, and I do think there was newsworthy stuff in there, perhaps not quite so much as some of the embassy cables from WikiLeaks a couple of years ago. It wasn't incredibly... Having seen what happened to Chelsea Manning, I think he's currently on hunger strike, who's just been... There's finally suggestions that she might get sex reassignment surgery, which would be the first person in US custody to get that. But, you know, going into that situation, knowing that you have these medical needs and that, you know, you're going to be... I mean, she was in solitary confinement for a really long time. That was a pretty big step for someone like Snowden to make, right?
So from his, from what I've seen from previous documentary System 4 and, the many interviews that we've seen with him, I saw him speaking at Future Fest last year. This wasn't I am a revolutionary or a freedom fighter type decision.
Julian Assange.
Yeah, he was, a guy who worked in the job that he did because he was a patriot and he cared about his country. And that's the same thing that you would see with Chelsea Manning and the same thing you'd see with Bill Binney, who's another whistleblower who used to work at the NSA. These people weren't doing this because they want to rip up the script. They want the US to be the country that it says that it is, a beacon of democracy and freedom to live up to its values. And they just saw hypocrisy. And so his decision was, I want to help the US reform and to be the country that it wants to be. And so that was his decision.
How big an impact did the Snowden files have?
So I think there's certainly still stuff coming out about it. People have asked him whether he was behind the Panama Papers, and he says that he would protect a whistleblower if they wanted him to, but he said in this case he would not take credit for that. It's all the stuff, well, it's kind of, it echoes and echoes and echoes. We know that the US and the UK government and, you know, even governments like Germany have had a mass spying programs that up until this point were not codified, not necessarily you know, legal under any law that exists yet, so that's what we found out. The it's kind of interesting to know that as citizens, but also I think the problem for me is, what can I actually do about that as an individual? You're like, great, okay, I know that they're spying on me, I know that they have the capacity to spy on me, but you know, how do I, if I don't want to be spied on, stop that from happening? And that's not clear.
Stephen, what was the political fallout like from Snowden? Because it was, I think it sort of fell into an unfortunate time when Labour was still not, you know, was still in their transitional period from, I guess, Blairite authoritarianism to kind of Corbynite ultra, you know, transparency and...
Yeah, and it was also in that weird time when the government kind of had its weird internal libertarian opposition, but it couldn't really express itself very much because they had Theresa May at the Home Office. I mean, my feeling is it hasn't actually changed the political conversation around surveillance in terms of Westminster and Whitehall all that much, not least because what they've effectively opted to do is go, okay, it's not legal, well, we will retroactively make it legal. It will have more of an impact in the States because they have a written constitution, and ignoring how relaxed or unrelaxed you are about surveillance, it is very clear that you cannot make what they're doing constitutionally overnight in the way you can just go, right, Snooper's Charter, okay, thanks, bye. The interesting question about those leaks is whether or not they can survive politically the fact that WikiLeaks has effectively become a partisan actor in the US election.
Yeah. Let's talk about that, because I mean, I you know, I've had problems with Julian Assange for many years, but I think that this last couple of months as a sort of organisation, it has taken a particularly sharp, well, an avowedly partisan anti-Clinton, and I think that some of the leaks that it has promulgated have fairly heavy Russian fingerprints over them, right? Which is another part of the Snowden saga. And I think he's been quite brave in saying he did a lunch with the FT with Alan Rusbridger, you know, about criticizing human rights abuses in Russia and criticizing some of Russia's actions, which when he is alive or, you know, at liberty, such as he is at liberty, only thanks to the sheltering of the Russian government, is quite a courageous thing to do.
Yeah, I think a lot of the... Well, so part of the challenge was there, you know, Ed and Sarah are in Hong Kong. They are trying to work out what to do next. And so they are calling around, as much as you call around, all of the countries in the world and say, you know, would you take us? By a kind of fluke of actually Hong Kong bureaucracy, the US had sent over a document asking for Ed Snowden's extradition. They'd spelt his middle name wrong. And Hong Kong were like, we are meticulous copy. We are meticulous fillers in of documents. And so that actually bought some time for Ed and Sarah to go to Moscow, but they already had planned to then go on to Cuba and then go on to Ecuador. The US retaliated while they were in the air and just cancelled his passport, so he could not get his next boarding pass. And so by virtue of the fact that that's where he was, that's where he stayed. And it was only after a few weeks, 40 days in the airport, that they decided, okay, so we're going to have to stay in Russia. And that really, really wasn't their first choice, because obviously it has a lot of implications. Since then, he's been accused of being a Russian spy. So it really wasn't without its challenges. But actually, physically speaking, if you want to be as far away from the US being able to get you as possible, you know, Russia is actually a great place to be. And obviously the challenge with Julian Assange is that he has, you know, since all of the WikiLeaks revelations or his involvement with WikiLeaks, he has been accused of sex crimes in Sweden. Whether he has, well, he has charges to answer, but that has not been, as Sarah Harrison would see it, you know, politically neutral. It's not just been that he has to go and answer that. It seems like people have been messing around in the background, you know, kind of inflating it and doing PR around it as and when it suits them. So these guys have challenges because, you know, the public perception is, you know, are they a freedom fighter? Are they a criminal? If they are a hacker, is it that they are climbing over walls that they shouldn't? Or are they exposing problems with systems that need to be changed? And so then adding in all of these kind of Russia and sex charges and stuff like that doesn't help any of their cases. And I guess it's still, do we objectively think that people like Julian Assange and Ed Snowden and Chelsea Manning and Bill Binney have done something positive, even if their characters may not always be infallible?
I think there's a big difference between those four people in that only one of them is cheerleading for someone who thinks that the problem with America is there are too many people who look like me in it. Like, yeah, I mean, ultimately, that is the way that WikiLeaks is behaving in the presidential election. You had a targeted data leak designed to disrupt the Democratic Convention, speculation over Hillary Clinton's health.
A tweet. I mean, we have to maintain this pretense that the WikiLeaks Twitter account isn't just Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy, about, you know, this mysterious object fell out of Hillary Clinton's hand when she was bundled into the car. And then they did a poll about, like, you know, does she secretly have allergies or MS or Parkinson's? I mean, they've gone pretty far down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole. And I think that's a really interesting lesson for Snowden, because I actually think he's seen that and he has kept himself very non-partisan and not made interventions or not even tied it into any kind of larger worldview or even kind of anti-imperialist worldview, right? He's just said, like, this is my thing. I talk about open access to information. And I think that's probably a lesson for the whistleblower of the future. If you want to be taken seriously and maintain your credibility, you know, Edward Snowden's still getting invited to big Nesta conferences, right? Whereas the only people who want to troll other people now invite Julian Assange to stuff. I question both of you, actually. It might be interesting. The DNC leaks is interesting. So this is all the whole tranche of stuff from the Democratic National Committee's servers. I was looking at there's a Politico story. It's an oral history of 9/11, and you've got Bush is stuck on Air Force One, basically, and they've got two phone lines in and out, and no one's, because it's 2001, no one's got a smartphone. And they kind of, you know, they just can't get any information on and off it. They're kind of flying over places and getting a bit of a flickery TV signal. But one of the things that kind of constantly comes up is actually how much of government communications now do people try and not do through official channels. You know, there's this whole thing about whether or not people were using GChat because it wasn't FOIable, were they using private email addresses? You know, the same thing, well, the thing that Hillary Clinton's been accused of is using a kind of essentially home email for work purposes. We know for a long time, you know, Osama bin Laden didn't have a phone, right? It's because he just assumed that that anything digital was trackable. How much has stuff like this changed how governments approach IT and IT security?
I mean, so perhaps slightly more broadly, we have seen massive moves over the last couple of years towards open data. The Open Data Institute was co-founded by Sir Tim Berners-Lee, one of the kind of fathers of the internet. And I've, in the last couple of weeks, met an awful lot of open data leaders from Kenya, from Colombia, and all over the world. So the general movement towards the idea that it is public data, it is not yours, and actually sharing it will mean that we have better institutions and better companies that can build on that kind of data, I think is just a really exciting change. And it's a real shift in the mindset for a lot of people in government, whether you're a civil servant or a politician. If we don't have anything to hide and you can track my communications all day long, then, you know, right back at you.
Yeah, I think the stuff about phone tracking is, I mean, when The Guardian were working on the Snowden stuff, they had a room which no one was allowed to walk with a mobile phone, because it's very easy to get malware onto a phone, right, that just turns on the microphone the entire time. You know, essentially you then, what's really nice about modern surveillance is you carry around your own bugging equipment with you.
I think the interesting thing is, so there's a kind of phenomena I'm getting increasingly obsessed with, which is that it feels that whenever there's a jump forward in technology, all of the assumptions people had about things you needed to regulate, people like, oh, look at this app, of which Uber, TaskRabbit, they are Deliveroo, they are all kind of the classic example, but in the way the original one is the Match Girls, right? There were already stricter labor laws surrounding children if they were on a farm. Then the Industrial Revolution happened and people were like, do we need those regulations in cities and around factories? They're disruptive. And of course you have that again with Uber, where suddenly people go, oh, that doesn't matter. And it is interesting how when, you know, when freedom of information first started to be talked about in the 70s and when it was finally enacted in 1997, this idea that you'd have a situation where the Secretary of State for Education, I think I am correct in saying that it is now accepted that they were using another email address to get round FOI.
Mrs. Blurt, I believe was the name of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. I wasn't sure if that is something we all know or it's something that we...
It's fine, it's on the podcast, it'll be okay.
It's been accepted. Yeah, we people wouldn't have expected that. And as ever, legislation in the civil service massively moves behind and kind of like, oh, new technology. It'll be interesting because one of the other purges that happened under May was all of the people who were into digital stuff in a big way, other than Matt Hancock, got sacked.
Hmm.
All of the people who are like, no, there are certain things that you ought to guarantee with a government IT contract, for example, have either been fired or their pull on Whitehall is much weaker than it was.
Yeah. So, well, the same thing happens with AI. I was talking to an AI researcher who said, you know, this is a really interesting area, but Tom Watson's been trying to set up a royal commission. Think of a great industry. Think of the airline industry, right? That is a high-tech industry that is incredibly tightly regulated. And as a result, it is incredibly safe. And actually, prices aren't... It's not... It is perfectly, you know, there is no capitalist constraint on running airlines. Lots of people do, right? But the EU's got very banned certain airlines from flying into the EU because otherwise you will fall out of the sky and die. And the same thing ought to happen with AI, and maybe the same thing ought to happen with surveillance. But as you say, it just takes a really long time to catch up.
I think one of the most interesting things for me is, I mean, if we talk about it as being big data, what Bill Binney from the NSA has talked about consistently in his revelations, and he also has a new film coming out, a documentary called A Good American, which is coming out a week after the Snowden one, is that all of this data is too much for spooks to go through. When they talk about what's in the investigatory powers bill,
it's bulk collection.
Yeah, bulk collection and internet connection records, which aren't actually a technically defined thing. If you put that on the desk of an analyst at the NSA or at GCHQ, there's too much stuff to go through. And so what Bill Binney and his team in their kind of skunk works, as they call it, little startup within the NSA created, was something that not only mapped every kind of internet connection in the world, but then was able to discard all the ones that weren't people of interest and people related to people of interest, because that actually gave them an opportunity to target the right people, whereas otherwise you're just flooding people with information that they don't need. The investigatory powers bill is currently going through the House of Lords, and the level of technical expertise of those people, while they might well be lawyers and they might well be, you know, have all sorts of other expertise, these people aren't telecoms people, they aren't technology people, but the likes of Apple and Microsoft and Facebook and Google have all come out and said, you know, this is technically the wrong thing to do. And that's backed up by Bill Binney and other people working in the surveillance community as well. It's just too much big data because we all have our little spy machines on us. But, you know, Helen is not necessarily thinking of doing anything wrong, Stephen and me. And, you know, so why?
I'd just like to make that very clear. I'm really not. But I think that's good. But you're right, because very, very often when there is a terrorist attack, you find out that actually the person's been known to the security services, right? And it's just this cruel fact, which is that the resources are limited. You can't trail everybody around for years on end, 24 hours a day, because you think that they might do something. Like that you can try and make it as smart as possible, but actually quite often the security services know who they think the bad guys are. It's just there's no minority report. They can't swoop on them before they do something. But thanks so much for joining us, Kirsty. We know that, unfortunately, this will be your first and last appearance on the NS podcast, as you were off to exciting new pastures. But thanks for joining us.
thanks so much for having me.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now for a section called You Ask Us, in which you ask us questions. You can find us on Facebook, I think you can find somebody. You can't find me on Facebook. You can find,
you can find me on Facebook.
Have you got a verified page now?
I've got. It's not verified, but I have got a page.
Okay. Well, find Stephen's fan page and maybe leave some fan art on there. Maybe some fan fiction. Find me on Twitter at Helen Lewis. It's a very quick one this week. Can Trump win and how?
So Trump can win. I would say at the start of the contest, Trump had about 20% chance of winning. I think one of the difficulties with probability, with predicting stuff, is that we're quite good at judging kind of 10% calls, 90% calls. People find it hard to get their head around the level of uncertainty around someone with a 20, 30% chance of winning, right?
Yeah, and also through America's crazy electoral college system, where if it's just, the people of Ohio go mental and just vote in a completely unpredictable way, then that throws the whole thing into confusion, right?
So, yeah, the way Trump wins would, yeah, his path to victory is basically he is normalized enough in the minds of Republican loyalists that despite their relative distaste for him, which is clearly declining in some, he gets all of those votes. Plus, it turns out that the dream of what it's now fashionable to call the old right, but are effectively just white supremacists in new money, their dream isn't you maximize the white vote and you get middle-class whites and white graduates in the North to vote in the way that the white working class in the South have voted. And that, with their new hires, is a big part of their appeal. And that's basically his path to victory, coupled with the fact that, obviously, Hillary Clinton is not very popular, and so you hope that there will be a lack of enthusiasm for her among the Democratic coalition. My instinct, however, isn't that won't happen.
That's what I want to hear, Cassandra of politics. I keep therapeutically going and looking at 538's Polls Plus, which has currently got Trump, I think, on about just under 20% chance of winning. I mean, he has to make some big gains in some states where he's not doing particularly well. I think I'm really quite interested to know what his money situation is like, what his ground organization situation is like. I mean, he always boasted he didn't have to do any advertising. He was his own free advertising. But the thing is, going on Fox News and saying outrageous things, great, really max out that Fox News viewership, right? But it's not necessarily reaching swing voters.
But also, I think, so there's a weird thing in that caucus elections are less representative than primary elections because people with the time to go to them are not representative. It's one reason, don't write in, Sanders fans, but it's one reason why Bernie did so well in caucus states. And we could see that in the places which had a caucus and then a non-binding primary. Mm. Then Hillary did better, and I think in one case actually won the alternative primary. It's why they did that deal with the Nevada unions to let people off work so they could vote for her, which is how she won Nevada. But caucuses also are a test of your organisation, right? If Bernie Sanders hadn't had a fairly well-organised campaign, the fact that he only appealed to mostly to white voters and some black millennials, but not all, wouldn't have been enough for him. The reason why Trump lost almost every caucus state to Ted Cruz is because he wasn't organised. You cannot win caucuses unless you have a good organisation, and it's quite difficult to get your voters to turn out without good organisation. I'm always sceptical of people whose plan is, well, we will activate non-voters, right? Because as the referendum showed, as Obama getting turnout up showed, actually as the massive spike in turnout in
lifts
Scotland after
boats.
The referendum. Yeah, that thing is, everyone's turnout goes up, right? More young people voted in the referendum than have voted in any election in British history ever. But unfortunately, even more old people voted than have voted in any other election ever. More working class people voted in the referendum than ever have, but more middle class people did. And so I cannot see a situation in which Trump is able to come up with a message and it sufficiently appeals to enough white voters that you do not then get remarkable turnout spikes among
Hispanics
and
I can't imagine his Muslim vote is low.
Yeah, and also the more worrying sign for them is, and state by state polls are less reliable this far out, but he's doing really badly among graduates in places like Georgia, among young, and it may be that actually his long term effect is to create a permanent halitosis around the Republican brand. There was the slight nerviness of Hillary's stumble. The clips looked bad. I myself did have a palpitation of like, oh God, is this the clip on a documentary about the rise of Trump? But my instinct is, the more I think about it, is there a demographic of people who are worried about fitness to become president, whose natural second home after Hillary stumbles is Donald Trump?
I think that would make more sense if Tim Kaine didn't look quite boring and quite accept. I mean, in a sense, Tim Kaine is more acceptable. To people who are worried about Hillary, he's more religious, he's a bloke, which helps. And he's not got a long history of, for people who dislike the Clintons historically, he's not got any kind of baggage like that. So that's one of my my tiny rays of hope, is that I don't think the prospect of, and I mean, there's lots of Bernie Sanders fans getting very excited on Facebook about like, oh, they're going to draft Bernie Sanders in, because, Facebook is now the primary home for people posting links to fake news sites. The one thing I think you said that I think is really important, though, is about the idea of normalising Trump. And I'm really worried about that. And I think the media has got a really big case to answer there. The natural tendency of the media to let people get into a post-gaffe wonderland, right? Which you saw happen with Boris, you saw happen with Nigel Farage, where that's just what they do. Yeah. And because they're still popular after doing it, we can't say, as Hillary tried to say, well, actually, the reason that his racist message is appealing to people is because those people are clearly racist, or like hold racist views. Because you can't say that. You just have to sort of then make it, oh, well, okay, that's now, of course, yeah, of course it's perfectly legitimate for a main party candidate to call for a wall to be built along the Mexican border, or call for all Muslims to be banned from, because it's a kind of a fait accompli, then you sort of have to retcon it into being an acceptable thing to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is one of the many problems of horse race journalism, which I myself often engage in, because it's kind of like going to McDonald's. It's fun.
It's fun. It's easy. You can write it very quickly.
Yeah, if you're writing a longer piece, you can.
It's like football transfer journalism, isn't it? Yeah. That's the problem. Everyone wants to read it because it's new and it's constantly exciting.
But there is a problem, exactly as you say, that, like that supposed gaffe. What she said was half of Trump's supporters
belong in a basket of deplorables.
Don't like mixed race marriage, don't like blacks, don't like Hispanics, don't like et cetera, and the other half are having a rubbish time and feel that we need some form of radical change. I mean, if you
look at all of
the polling
of Trump, there was a great
Ta-Nehisi
Coates piece that just said most people they think it's very rude to her to have said it. They don't think that it's untrue because it is. It is. If you look at the polling, you have some crazy amount of people who voting for Trump, who actually think that, slavery should never have ended, right? Or like the South should secede and be allowed to, and I mean, it was just kind of like, the civil rights movement was on balance a bad thing. There are definitely, as you say, white supremacists supporting him.
And I think it is, and I think particularly, I mean, less so in America, where they have less excuse because their broadcasters don't have to be balanced. I don't think that our press here covered itself in glory in the way it covered the referendum. It covered it as if it was a family tiff within the Conservative Party. Brexit, in reality, is going to be our national project in England and Wales.
And it didn't solve the false equivalence, right? It definitely did not, which is exactly what's happening. I saw a great tweet that said, yes, Trump wants to ban Muslims from America, but Hillary used her work email at home. And that's been the questions over the Clinton Foundation. Actually, no one has managed to stand up. There are potential conflicts of interest if you meet donors who then, but they have all been declared. Whereas Trump's money is largely unexplored. He still won't release his tax returns, and it's this sort of bizarre search to find things, because you've said really horrible things about Trump. The search to find some horrible things to say about Hillary, so that you can go, of course, we're actually completely neutral. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it is. Deeply troubling. My instinct, though, is that it will, touch wood, be fine in the States, unlike Brexit, where we still, I think, have not yet. I think most people are still not covering it with the seriousness it.
No, I think there's been a big rush of boosterism afterwards to say, well, the economy's doing all right at the moment, therefore Brexit is fine. And actually, to criticise, I guess, our side, there were things like the punishment budget, like Osborne's 4,300. There were things that were sort of plucked out of the air in this kind of apocalyptic doom and gloom, because it was deemed too complicated to make a case of there will be slower growth for years on end. It's just not, not Project Fear. So I think that's been the problem. But I think anybody who's sort of crowing about how brilliant things are should remember that we haven't We haven't left the European Union yet. We haven't stopped any of our, you know, we haven't left the single market. All our tariffs and trade agreements are all exactly as they were on June the 22nd.
And we have no idea what the negotiating position of what is ultimately 27 different countries with 27 different electorates, with 27 different sets of priorities, with 27 different feelings about this referendum.
With 27 lack of interest in Britain's prosperity, right? That's the thing. That they care no less that Britain gets a great deal than we care than, you know, the Hungary's doing well at the moment.
Yeah, and I was talking to someone from a large multinational business about Philip Hammond's idea. Then, you know, you might be able to get business in Europe to lobby them. And they said, well, that's a great idea. It should work in theory. Of course, we had business lobbying not to have a European referendum and not to leave the European Union. So we've seen how effective that is. And yeah, if Trump wins, the US media will have questions to answer, which will be on a
well, they'll
even
be answering
scarier...
them from a camp that he will have put them in, right? Because he is explicitly running against the media. He's banned media from his events. He puts them in pens where they can get, his supporters, like, has bits during his events where everyone can turn and kind of do the 2-minute hate at journalists. Yeah. It is not, you know, these are turkeys who are writing fair and balanced things about Christmas.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, at least to be fair to our nation's media, fairly rubbish coverage of Brexit. At least, actually, Brexit is not going to be that bad for, you know...
For journalists. Well, there's a happy thought to end on. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.